on this edition of the Car Jam podcast.
Something else that's going to make this really hard is we know that human drivers are going to react differently to autonomous cars than normal cars. And, you know, one thing is, if you know the car is going to stop, are you just going to jaywalk all the time because you know that thing is going to stop?
Is the plan that it would be something that I could fit to Mike's car, but you'll need to get the floors welded up first, Mike.
I daily drove that Foxbody Mustang to work in Michigan winters for 2 years. And if there is something that will make you hate your car, it's daily driving. There's a big difference between using the car for utility and enjoying a car on sort of a nice country road on a nice day.
Stand by. Here comes a first. There's a serious risk you might actually get something useful out of today's episode. Whilst I might be a touch biased, I can tell you that I was personally so interested in the content, I forgot that I was supposed to be editing it and ended up just listening to it. Anyway, surprisingly, it wasn't me or my car chum Mike that did the fascinating. It was a bona fide expert. Mike, we'll explain more.
Hey, welcome to Car Chum. Tony sent me an email last night asking, some might say insisting, that I comb my hair and tidy the place up a bit. And as you can see, I spent at least 3 hours considering that before not bothering. But the reason is, we've got a guest. It's Noah Gedrimus, Vice President of Ground Positioning Radar. Now, that's intriguing. So, welcome, Noah. Can you explain who you are, what you do?
Yeah, sure. I live in Michigan and came from kind of the engineering side, and I work on a positioning system for autonomous vehicles. And our company is called GPR, or Ground Positioning Radar.
Sounds complicated.
Yeah, should we leave it there? I think it went really well to that point.
That's the last thing I understood. Good.
Now, what's on your driveway in reality, and what's on the driveway in your head?
Well, I would say, I assume you're talking about what my fleet of vehicles is. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Not the lawnmower. No.
Yeah.
It's a Honda, by the way.
Oil stains is what's on my driveway.
I have some cars that are fully assembled and drivable, and I have quite a few that are in progress. I still have my first car from high school, which is a 87 Foxbody Mustang. And that that was my high school purchase, actually before I had a license. Simply because it's the fastest you can go for, you know, under $2,000 and
302?
302, yeah.
302 cube, yep. 5 liter.
Put another engine in it, another transmission and so forth. And so I still have that car here in Michigan. If you can believe it, I daily drove that through Michigan winters for 2 years. And that is, that was really hard on the car and really hard on me. And so that car is pretty much rusted out. And so I bought another car. It's a 91 Mustang, which is the same body style, but unfortunately they changed a fair amount of wiring and things in it. And that's a roller chassis, so it doesn't have an engine or transmission. And I've been slowly moving parts over from my first car to this, you know, clean, straight car. And that's been going on for over 5 years now. So that's been a very, very slow progress. And then the other really cool car I bought my wife last year, and that's the 2019 Mustang Bullitt, which is sort of a throwback car. And so she doesn't really let me drive that one, but I get to look at it in the garage. So that's nice.
So this was the...
That has badging, bullet badging, doesn't it? It does, instead of Mustang, does it? Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So it doesn't say Mustang or Ford anywhere on it. It's all the bullet badging, but not... not too far off the GT car. A different engine tune and a little bit more power, different wheels, has some chrome on it. And then it comes with the stick shift with the cue ball shifter. So that's pretty nice. Cool. Yeah. And it's got a really nice green color on it as well. So
Highland green, is it?
Yeah. I think it's
like the original 68.
Yep. Yeah.
Love those. So you're a Mustang guy then.
Yeah. It seems to be. My daily driver is a Land Rover LR2, which I think was called the Freelander 2 in the UK. And I actually really like that car. It has like an inline six from a Volvo in it. And it's just been a really great car.
Yeah, we're lulling you in with the easy questions first, Noah. Before we do the insights of journalism.
Yeah, I'll talk about cars all morning here. That'd be great.
So autonomy, Noah, it's the future. There's an awful lot of AI about at the moment. Can I just preface this whole conversation with my tuppence on it, which is hardly worth tuppence, but AI everything. I mean, you know, the media and the public, it has set, you know, minds alight, hasn't it? And, you know, I saw a fan heater for sale the other day, and I kid you not, on the box, it says, with AI built in. I mean, what they actually meant is it's got a thermostat in it. With that as a backdrop, we thought on Karchan we really ought to look at the future rather than way back when in the past, Mike. Mm. Sorry. You seem like an excellent place to start. Autonomy. What is autonomy? Can you define that into something that even I can understand?
Yeah, so autonomy covers so many different sort of variants that it gets a little bit confusing at times. And I know a lot of people get confused as to what an autonomous car is and what it's not. And so at sort of the minimum, sometimes people think of a lane keeping system, which is like what almost every premium car, even just every car has now, where it can sort of stay in the center of the lane using a camera and then slow down for the car in front. And they call that autonomy or autonomous. And then at the most extreme would be something like, go pick my kids up from school, you know, and your car just drives off and goes pick your kids up from school. And all of it is referred to as autonomy or autonomous driving by somebody. And so maybe a good place to start is what's called the SAE levels of automation. And it's not a perfect sort of description. But SAE, or Society of Automotive Engineers, broke down the autonomy into five levels. And maybe at its most basic, an SAE level one is maybe like a blind spot detection. So that's where like your light turns on, you know, and this is really aiding the driver, helping the driver do a better job. And then an SAE level two is where the autonomy system take control of the steering or the brakes or both, but the operator of the vehicle is fully engaged and fully paying attention and ready to take control immediately. And so this is almost every system you see on the car. And what's interesting is there's no definition of what's called operational design domain for these levels. And operational design domain is like, where does it work? Right. So for the lane keeping systems, they always work on the highway when they can see lane markings, but they won't work on maybe a surface street. So that's called the operational design domain. And so that's SAE level one and level two. In level two, you're always engaged. You're always paying attention. Then when you move to level three is where the driver can disengage or not be watching the road for some period of time. And they don't define that specifically, but usually it's like maybe 10 or 15 seconds. And so this might be the car can maintain the lane. It can stay in, you know, it doesn't need any assistance. And you can be looking down and working on your computer or you know, using your phone or something like this. But then if the car...
So just texting like everyone does at the moment.
Right, texting. Mm-hmm. And if the car beeps, you have to come back and be engaged in the driving within some amount of time. Usually about 10 seconds is what they say. And what's interesting, though, is for those 10 seconds from when the car is driving autonomously and when the driver comes back to engage, the autonomy system has to be able to deal with anything that could happen. I mean, anything. You know, there's an accident in front or, you know, there's a pedestrian that walks out onto the highway or whatever the case is, the car needs to pull over. And that's a big challenge. Now you move to level four. Level four is where the vehicle can take full operation or the autonomy system can take full operation of the vehicle within a given operational domain. So it can completely drive. You don't need to pay attention. You don't need to be engaged. And if there's an issue, the car can pull over or stop on its own safely. And now there's still a operational design domain that it's limited to. So it might be that level four, there's a section of highway that's mapped really well and the car can operate without you paying attention on that section of highway. And you know, pull over and you completely disengage and it's not going to beep and say, please take control right now. But that car can't even drive on a surface street, even with you paying attention. That's kind of a big difference between design domain and level four. And then level five autonomy, there's no restriction on operational design domain, which means it could operate on any road, anywhere in the world, in any weather condition. And that's kind of misunderstood a lot, but level five is sort of...
Is that that's the Johnny cab in Total Recall?
I don't even know if that could do level five. So level five is very commonly misunderstood. And a lot of companies say they're working on level five, and I don't think they really understand what that means, because it means like driving up a Himalayan pass and you know, in a snowstorm, effectively. And nobody's really working on that. Where, you know, level four with a big operational design domain, saying like all public roads in Europe, with the level four, that's plenty of challenge on its own.
What surprised me looking into this in the first, not exactly self-driving car, but they had a remote control system in the mid-1920s that you could drive a car up the street and somebody behind was effectively operating at radio control. And then in the 50s, they came up with General Motors had the Firebird 2 concept car, and that ran off wires under the street. And it was getting feedback from the wires all the time as to where it was. It's a little bit like a slot car.
That's right.
Kind of thing. So what I was going to say is what level are we competently at now between one and five?
That's so everything I talked about there, I was sort of talking about cruising functions, or this is where, you know, like a passenger car on a public road on the highway. And with that, I would say we're somewhere between level two and level three. For like consumer owned cars. And that's, there's a lot of level two systems that, you know, the car maintains the lane pretty safely. There's one publicized level three system from Mercedes. But the operational design domain is limited so much. It's something like, I don't want to mess up too much, but it's the car has to be going between like 10 miles an hour and 45 miles an hour. It has to be in a middle lane on a highway. It has to be a restricted access highway, and there has to be other cars around, and then it'll be level three. But if it goes faster than 45, or there's no cars around, or you're on a different type of highway, or it starts raining, it drops back to level two. And, you know, it sounds like that's kind of silly, but the reason is because once you step up to level three, the car has to be able to deal with anything that can happen. And so by them saying, well, if there's cars around us, then we know there's no pedestrian on the highway. Like, I think that's one limitation they use, because pedestrians are very difficult to predict. Mm. Now, what's interesting, though, is that there's a lot of level four features and applications outside of automotive, or even within automotive, for like parking. So, for example, a valet parking system. This is where you get out of your car and push a button on your phone, and the car would go navigate the garage and go park. That's actually level four, because there's nobody's hovering over the car ready to hit a red button to stop it. It's really on its own. And that's an easier application, because if something goes wrong, it can kind of just stop in the middle of the parking garage and turn on its hazard lights, and, you know, nobody gets hurt. It's not great, but it's
sit there going, help, I don't know where I am.
Right. But, you know, if you're on the highway and there's a problem, the car gets a flat tire or something, you can't just stop in the middle of the road and turn on your hazard lights. It's just a big reason that the operator is still there, is just for those really rare edge cases. And actually, most of our focus at GPR in the last year and a half or so has been off-highway applications. So things like autonomous mining vehicles. In seaports, there's these vehicles that move the containers, so the cranes unload the ships and put them on these AVs, they're called, and they drive autonomously around. Now, these are all level four. There's no remote operators. There's nobody on the vehicle. And they can do that because they just restrict the areas that the mining trucks and the seaports operate in. So there's no human-driven vehicles. There's no surprises.
They're self-contained.
They're self-contained, yeah. So there's a lot of really cool level four stuff there. So that's why it's kind of a tricky question when people say, well, where are we? We're level two or level four? And then, of course, there's other stuff. There's like shuttles. Like I don't know if you've ever seen at the Heathrow Airport, they have the pods that take you between the air. Yeah. So that's a level four autonomous vehicle.
Car park, the premium premium car park.
Exactly.
Well, we've not the verge you leave your BMW on, Mike, but by the M25. But.
Right.
Well, we've got the Docklands Light Railway as well in London, and that sort of runs up and down, and that is exactly that. It's a pod, and you can sit in the front, and there is no driver. So it's these are obviously working, but then they're on a track. There's only so much it can go wrong, really.
So that's actually kind of a great segue into what we do at GPR, actually, believe it or not. So all of these autonomous vehicles, or at least most of them, they operate on some sort of a map, right? And the map tells the vehicle kind of where it is and where it needs to go. So at its simplest, on like a highway case, the map says this is where the center of the lanes are on the highway. In the case of the pods, at Heathrow Airport, that map has like a trajectory or a desired center, lane center that the vehicle needs to follow. Same thing with the mining trucks or the seaports. They have routes or sort of lines that they want to follow, similar to train tracks, but there's no tracks there. And the process of taking the vehicle's position and comparing it to where it is relative to the path it wants to be on, that's called localization in robotics. And at its simplest, like if you have a paint stripe, so if you drew like a paint stripe on the ground, the vehicle measuring its position relative to that paint stripe, that's usually done with a camera, and that's a localization modality or method of localization. Now, the problem with most localization is that it's very susceptible to adverse weather conditions. So if it starts to snow and there's snow on the pavement, you can't see the lane markings anymore, right? Or if it starts to rain really hard, your camera can't really see anymore because its perception is blocked. And other things can happen in like mine sites. You get extremely dusty scenarios, so you can't see anything. Or even in dynamic environments. So like in the seaports, there's often so many containers and vehicles around that if you had a camera or a LiDAR or radar or something, you can't see what you need to see to position. So what we do at GPR is we use what's called a ground penetrating radar. And the ground penetrating radar can actually see right through the pavement, see right through the ground, several meters deep. So 10 feet deep. And we can create a signature or like a fingerprint of what the ground looks like under the route we want the vehicle to drive on. And even if there's a layer of snow or dirt or debris on the ground, we can match to that subterranean layer, and we can keep these autonomous vehicles operating even when the weather's poor, even when there's, really dynamic environments or GPS connection problems. And so there's like a lot we're applying in off-highway in the mining and seaport cases in particular, but then also it's going back to automotive, and we're starting to apply it to keep your car centered in the lane on the highway, even in adverse weather. Because if you've used any of those lane keeping systems, when the sun's in the wrong place or it starts raining or it starts snowing, they don't work.
Yeah. I'm guessing though, Noah, you're going to need to spend a few dollars on a nice big hard drive. If you're going to map out every road, can you imagine trying to back that up as well? So I'm going to back up tonight. Because you're talking about presumably huge volumes of data, because a sat nav only has to look at a road, doesn't it? A global positioning has to look at a road. If you're talking about looking under the ground, you're then looking at, in America, four or five lane highways, whatever. You've got to multiply it four or five times because you can't just scan one lane, can you?
Yeah, so that's a good point. Now, in autonomous driving, almost all of these vehicles are operating on what we call HD maps or high definition maps. And they're different than what you'll see in your sat-nav that's like a much simpler, kind of lines. And most of these systems have lots of features in the map that they use for localization. So if you look at like what Google Waymo is doing with their autonomous vehicles, their maps have really dense LiDAR point clouds. And, LiDARs are these kind of high accuracy laser systems that can detect features in the environment. They're very expensive and they create massive, massive amounts of data.
Hang on, sorry, just to put it in my language, right? You can get iPhone Pro and whatnot, no doubt, other phones as well, that have some kind of LiDAR. Okay, so they go into a room and they bounce lasers around? No, bounce they something bounce, around?
Yeah, they are the lasers that sort of bounce around, and they detect features around the vehicle. And those are used, and they're all added to a map. And that map ends up being very, very large and takes terabytes of hard drive space to deal with.
But that can change. Because if you... If anything can change on the road, the pavement, the road layout. If you're in your seaport, someone just moves one container that's supposed to be
it's exactly right. So
imagine a mining situation that's constantly changing. They're always digging away. Every time it comes back, something will be different.
Yeah. That's right. And so using surface features or LIDARs are very limited in your ability to localize reliably because the environment's always changing. And your LIDAR's ability to detect other features can be blocked. So with the ground penetrating radar, the data under the ground almost never changes because it's protected by the ground. And then to the data question, the data is orders of magnitude smaller than the LIDAR data. And there's a couple reasons for that. Okay. So for one, the LIDAR is seeing hundreds of meters in every direction. And in 360 degrees around the vehicle. And so you end up with this very large point cloud that you need to collect all this data. The ground penetrating radar, we're only seeing, 10 feet into the ground and just the area under the vehicle. So it's a much smaller area we're looking at.
And how often is that snapshotted? So every meter or every half meter or what?
On average, every inch. It depends on the vehicle for you. Okay. But we're taking these scans and sort of compressing them from the radar into a map layer, and we could map with any vehicle with a GPR on it, and then localize with that vehicle.
What kind of speed is a safe speed to be doing this at? Is there a maximum? Is there a?
Well, we actually did some testing on the Autobahn with it a few years ago, and they were localizing or sort of positioning on the map at over 140 miles an hour. So it wasn't driving autonomously at the time, but we're showing the positioning aspect. There's a lot more that goes into the autonomous driving than just localization, just knowing where you are. But the ground positioning radar portion is not speed limited in that way.
Could you not, for collecting all this data, and instantly, if you go ahead and use this idea, just a small percentage, that's all I ever ask for.
All about for money with you, ideas. Isn't it, Tony?
Yeah, that's it. Could you not sort of crowd do it insofar as, I have this thing attached to my car that and I receive the benefit of semi-automation or automation and an enhanced navigation experience, but I'm also putting back that information when I drive on a road that you haven't been on before.
That's absolutely right, So our data layer, we can build using a crowdsource method. And the way that works is that all of the vehicles equipped with the ground penetrating radar can be used to annotate the map, to update the map, to add to it, and it can be done in real time. And that's a big aspect of what we're doing. So a typical an automotive go-to-market strategy for us would be we build a seed map first, and this would be where we map maybe one lane of a section of highway for certain routes. And then the map can organically grow as a customer fleet is operating on that area.
Quite quickly as
actually, depending on where they're driving. And the map can be compressed and done change detection on board the vehicles, meaning that the vehicles are each looking for changes in that subterranean environment.
Okay.
And then they can just update to the cloud or upload to the cloud at the end of the day or the end of the week any changes or suggested updates.
Differences. Yes.
Let me ask a stupid question, if I may.
Please, so please.
Yeah, because I do that better than anyone else I know. So it's doing the ground penetrating radar. What happens when you drive over a bridge?
Yes, that's a good question. It actually works fine on bridges.
Is it?
Yeah. When I first joined the company, I was really interested to see what would happen in parking garages, like multi-level parking garages.
Well, yeah.
Because
when it's up in the air,
right, and for a couple of reasons, so one is we're looking at 10 feet of data usually, and then if you take a multi-level parking garage, you're only looking at maybe 8 to 10 inches of concrete that's supporting the structure, and then on top of that, those concrete structures that they build parking garages out of, They're actually made in a factory. They're called Spancrete, and they're sort of these slabs of concrete that come on a truck and they put them together. And so presumably they'd all be very similar. They'd be homogeneous, meaning that the radar wouldn't be able to detect one to the other. And we've done quite a bit of testing now in parking garages and bridges and things, and we find it's very easy to localize. There's lots of data, and the nature of the ground penetrating radar return from going through concrete is actually very character rich, meaning there's just, it's almost like a QR code. There's so much information in that data, it makes it really easy to position with. And that's not something I expected, you know, because I think to my mind, I thought, yeah, concrete, it's pretty homogeneous. Like, you know, but to the radar, it comes back, quite character rich and makes it easy for us to match with.
And hopefully that would help speed up the level 4 parking that a friend of mine demonstrated on his Tesla 3 when he first got it out in the car park. I was like, mate, you know, I've got to get back into work soon. You know, is this thing actually going to work?
And so,
I can't imagine anyone actually using that feature unless they've got a holiday, you know, to use up.
Well, see, so that was, even though you weren't in the car, that's a level 2. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's level 2 is because you have to watch it. You know, if you could push a button and then just leave, that would be level 4. But since you're there, ready to stop it, I don't know, would you hold a button down on the phone or something to tell it you're still watching? Yeah, but
it wouldn't work very well with the Dukes of Hazzard either, would it? I mean, they jump generally everywhere. They're always like 20 feet in the air. It'd always be, I don't know where we are.
Yep.
Where are we going to land?
Could it work for... seeing as my last idea went down so well, let's try this one. This one might sink. Water or not, because you've got such a huge depth.
Yeah, presumably. To an extent, it can work in water. If you have like really deep standing water, like really big puddles, so say several inches thick, we get like a reflection off it. But a couple things about the water.
Okay.
You know, one is that's on our pipeline this year. We're going to fix the water issue so that we can drive through even deep standing water. And that just has to do with kind of tweaking the radar to work in deeper water. But also, if your autonomous vehicle is driving through, you know, deep standing water, there's so much water splashing around that all the cameras and other sensors can't see anyway. So it's, you know, we're not talking about little puddles or little trenches in the road. It's for some of our mining customers, specifically for underground mining. They're driving those things through really deep water and they want us to be able to position. So that's something we're looking at.
Does the system cope okay with ice?
Yes.
Is there any special issues?
Ice and snow, actually the radar sees through very easily. It's called the dielectric constant, or sort of the resistance to radar of snow and ice is much, much lower than water. So the radar sees through that just fine, along with other debris. And you know, something to keep in mind is if the radar can see through 10 feet of concrete, you know, a layer of snow or ice or dirt or debris, you know, the sensor getting muddy, none of that is going to really affect it.
Is there any sort of archaeological data that kind of comes back from this? Could you sort of see people driving over something and go, well, there's like a Roman hoard of coins down there or something?
That's
useful. Maybe.
We get asked that a lot. So we did not invent ground penetrating radar. So ground penetrating radar was back to like the 50s or maybe even farther back. And it's mainly used for surveying like that, for detecting ruins and geographical surveys, things like this. And the radar we use, we're a lot less interested in what's underground so much as that the radar return is consistent for that area. So we do know, though, that the radar wavelengths we're using, we can detect things like, infrastructure or fault lines or potential potholes, things that are forming underground before they form. It just hasn't been a main focus of ours. So it's kind of like a little bit farther down the path that when we have vehicles equipped with the ground positioning radars and they're continuously driving through cities, they'll be able to give sort of dynamic maps of how the ground is changing over time and do predictive maintenance and say maybe something is, this is the degradation of the bridge over time, or this is where all the pipes are under your city, up to a certain level.
Oh, they dig them up every day anyway, so there's going to be very little difference.
Actually,
there.
kind of funnily, right outside of our office in Somerville, there was like a sinkhole that formed, you know, last year, and it was kind of fun. The engineers were looking at the, you know, the older data before and after from where we were testing out there to see if they could see how the ground was changing, and yeah, it was interesting.
I can see this catching on really fast when the first few people, every time they go out, they find $5,000 worth of gold.
That's right. That's like, right. Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah. Went down the shops. I found some oil.
Yeah. It's such a kind of novel place to look. And it's, you know, I've been working in autonomous driving for about 10 years and spent a lot of time thinking about it. And the areas that it's hardest to do this localization is when there's really no features around, you know, there's nothing around you to localize yourself. And so, or everything around you looks the same. So for example, if you're in a tunnel, everything looks the same. You know, where are you in that tunnel? You don't really know. Or if you're operating in the desert, so we have lots of long desert roads in the U.S., especially in the Southwest, you can drive for, you know, 10, 15 miles and there's nothing to localize with. There's nothing to see on the side of the road. And, the, you know, robots have the same problem. But what I'd never occurred to me before I started at GPR was to look straight down through the pavement. And there's all of this stuff underground that we can use to position. And same thing within the tunnels. You know, when we're in the tunnels or these homogeneous environments, it's like if you're looking through the pavement, there's so much data there to use. And so it's kind of this whole other dimension to helping cars position. And so now I'm always thinking about, hey, what's under the road here? I wonder if
it's the roof. Yeah, it's the reverse of what the old adage is, isn't it? You know, which is, you know, kind of stop looking down and look up and it might change your life and change your perspective.
I like that. Start looking down.
Yeah, we were all so busy listening to that. We didn't look down. It only took one guy. Oh, wait a minute, that would work. Yeah. Is it expensive to fit in a car? I mean, I appreciate it probably is at the moment. I mean, new tech always is. But is the plan that it would be something that I could, I was going to say that I could fit to Mike's car, but you'll need to get the floors welded up first, Mike. It needs something solid to screw
we'll
onto.
We'll make it easier because there's rust holes in the car. That's one less layer of metal to go through.
Yeah, I know how that goes, yeah.
No, yeah, but could they be retrofitted or are we talking about only on sort of more modern vehicles?
It would depend on the vehicle type. So, you know, on like a pickup truck or something like this, we have like a hitch mount, you know, where we can put it kind of into the hitch of the vehicle and not too bad. And then all of our test vehicles, we mount it to sort of the pinch welds of the chassis and it goes underneath the car. It's like under the floor of the car.
Yeah. What size is it?
Yeah. So we have a couple of variants, but our smaller sensor is 80 centimeters wide, which is roughly a little over 2 feet. 2 feet wide, and then it's about a little over an inch thick. So it's very thin, and it's a sort of an aluminum box chassis, and we can put it underneath the car. And that thinness allows us to put it under lots of very low hanging vehicles.
So that would go in a bumper, say, wouldn't it? You could fit that in the bumper of, say, your Fox Mustang.
Exactly. Yeah. So actually, in one of the cars, we're going to put it kind of where the spare tire normally is in the back there. Or it can be used as a splash shield or put above like the plastic, air dams they put under cars. It can be integrated into an electric battery pack on some of the EVs. And then, of course, for all the off-highway stuff, for like the pods or the, the mining vehicles or so forth, they have tons of places to package it.
Yeah.
And then from a cost standpoint, of course, in the prototype phase, we're building them in sort of low volume, getting different customers to test and things. So they're not, not crazy cheap now. But as we mature and the volume goes up, there's nothing inherently expensive about the design. And so we should be, on par with like a automotive premium radar. And once we reach automotive volumes, which is already a package, sometimes cars have 5 or 6 of them. Around the car. So if you think about that radar on the front bumper of a car.
I'm finding it slightly reassuring talking to you. Maybe it's because, Mike, we're talking to someone who actually knows what they're doing for a change. But because you are a car guy, clearly, a Mustang guy. I'm sure Camaro guys would say you're not there.
There's none of those left. There's no Camaro guys left.
You like your stick shift and V8 engine stuff. So this is what I'm finding reassuring, that you get the passion that that we have as a car community, but you're developing something that I might, if I put my sort of Philistine's hat on, I might say, nah, that's for the birds, that's for the future, I'm not interested in it. But you being someone that is actually interested in cars, you, for example, would not wish to continue developing this if you couldn't drive your Mustang, would
no,
you?
No, like I said, I daily drove that Fox Body Mustang to work in Michigan winters for 2 years. And if there is something that will make you hate your car, it's daily driving it. There's a big difference between using the car for utility of, like, you know, getting to work and you know, sitting in traffic and enjoying a car on sort of a nice country road on a nice day. And I think we need to, you know, we need to separate those things. Using cars for transportation, the current cars are very limited in that people aren't paying attention, right? They're on their phones, they're not engaged. And so autonomy will, of course, help that. There's a lot of people that aren't interested in cars anymore. So certainly the younger generation, they just want to get to work. They want to Uber, they want to whatever. And all of that plugs up the roads for where, you know, I want to drive my Mustang and presumably you want to drive your sports cars. And so I really don't connect the two together. I always find it crazy that, you know, the people that, daily drive like an M3 BMW or something. I just don't get it. I'm sort of, you know, what, that's just going to make you hate your car. You know, if you're just going to sit in traffic and worry about it getting hit by a shopping cart. I mean, I love having a beater car just because it makes me appreciate my, you know, the car that I like.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
So I don't know. I think I'm definitely not pessimistic that they're going to stop us from, you know, driving cars we like driving on the road. Yeah, I think a lot of these autonomy things are going to help more than they're going to hurt.
Well, I guess that is an interesting point. I mean, my immediate gut reaction before speaking to you was, oh, no, I love driving my car. I hate anything that would take away from me being in control of the car. But I guess if you put it in a way of, you know, there's a snowstorm outside, you've got to drive somewhere you've never been before, but the car will be able to get you there. The car will, if you hit ice, have more control over it than you could. The car will say, you know, the turn's coming up, or, you know, there's a block in the road up there. Here's a quicker way to get there. And also, certainly what you said a moment ago, if I take out my classic car, there is a fear of it being damaged by someone who's texting, who's not concentrating. But if every other vehicle on the road is also looking and knows I'm there and is taking action, so if I make a mistake, 9 other cars around me are already braking that I haven't even seen, then it's safer for me, it's safer for my car. So it's not necessarily a retrograde step, it's actually a safety factor, isn't it?
The places that autonomous driving is going to be used is mainly areas where humans don't want to do it. It's either super boring, or they're worried about texting, or it's very dangerous. So a lot of the mining, you know, applications, especially the underground mining, the big motivation on the autonomy is that it's not a safe place for humans to be operating. And, you know, that's where the, at least in the short term, you're going to see the autonomy get applied first. And, you know, like the, you know, kind of country roads, like I live on a dirt road here in Michigan, and I actually prefer driving on that to driving on, you know, the paved roads, even though it destroys my car and it gets slippery in the winter. And it's just because there's no cars and I enjoy it. That's going to be a long time before that's made automated. And a big part of that is because it's not that horrible of a thing to do. But some of the places that the autonomy is getting applied really soon here is like traffic jam assist, which is basically just follow the car in front in this horrible traffic jam on my way to the airport because I don't want to deal with it. And so I really see it as a positive. I don't think it's going to replace like your, you know, driving a convertible in you know, on nice country roads near the, you know, near the ocean.
Taxis or sort of delivery trucks and things, or heavy trucks.
Your first step.
Yeah. So the trucking is a space we'll see it a lot sooner in than certainly the robo-taxi application. So, of course, there's companies like, you know, Cruise and Waymo that are working very hard on the robo-taxi application. The business case is really difficult there, though. The operational domains that they're operating in are very complex. There's pedestrians and bicyclists and everything you could imagine in these cities. And so it means that the systems have to be very complex and very expensive. And so, you know, their autonomous vehicles cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases. And, you know, operating a fleet of those with sort of remote supervisors and so forth, the business case is so hard on that to make money, especially when you're competing with Uber Lyft, you know, where it's just very difficult. Now, in the trucking space, there's a lot more space for a business case because the operational domain a lot of times is quite simple, especially on the long haul trucking in the U.S. So going from like, you know, El Paso to Tucson, you know, these Southwest cities, there's no snow, there's no rain. There's rain, but there's no snow. There's no really horrible conditions. And there's a sort of driver shortage. So there's a limit of how many people want to do these drives normally. And so that's a marketable space. And then like the mining cases, operating mining trucks and, you know, the outback of Australia or South America and some of these really hostile environments, very, very expensive to get somebody to drive these trucks. They're not going to enjoy it. That's where the autonomy will really get applied first. I'd say where you have that mismatch of it's really not that complicated to a robot to operate and really a horrible environment for a human. That's where you're going to find the autonomy really hit first.
Has there been any feedback from, say, the truck drivers? Have you spoken to any? Are they embracing the idea? Or
it's kind of a little bit of a mix, right? So there's certainly some that think of it as, oh, this is going to, you know, take my job. And that's, of course, not good. And they don't like that. But others see it as there's still going to be needed systems or drivers to operate the vehicles within a given city, let's say. And then there's this hub to hub modality where it's sort of the long haul trucking, you know, the 2 days of trucking across the United States. This will be done autonomously. Then they'll drop the trailer. Then I can live in my city and come home to dinner every night with my family and not be doing this long haul trucking. And there's opportunity there. And at this stage, there's such a driver shortage, at least in the US, that I don't think there's much of a risk of them, you know, the truckers losing, you know, massively losing their jobs and having to retrain. But they don't all see it that way.
The model we land on there, said he, sounding like an expert who knows nothing, is not dissimilar to air travel with the hub and spoke, where the long haul stuff is done and actually substantially automated by the aircraft these days, isn't it? And then presumably the short haul stuff is rather more human intensive. I don't know where I'm going with that. I just thought it sounds like a similar kind of model.
It sounded like you were going somewhere there.
I was intrigued.
Yeah, that's kind of a way to look at it, I'd say. The other thing that I have heard, and this hasn't happened yet, but eventually we will likely get to a stage with on-road autonomy where malevolence steps in. And you do have some trucker that try to run automated trucks off the road, let's say. And that can be a big, a big concern. And I've talked with some truckers that have said as much, that if I saw an autonomous truck on the road, I would try to steer it off the road. I don't think he was joking. So I actually got my commercial driver's license a few years ago to learn more about how to make trucks autonomous and operate them. And I did a couple road trips with a 53-foot semi truck in the U.S. Got to talk to truckers, and that was one thing that came up, was there's definitely some protection of their jobs in mind. And me kind of educating them a little bit about, you know, hey, it's not like one day, you know, you're not going to be able to get the keys into your truck and the thing's going to drive off. It's going to be slow, the adoption, and it's going to be the jobs that you don't want to do. It's going to be the drives that you don't want to do because they're boring. And that's...
Yeah, I like you know, I've done my heavy goods truck license as well, and I've done a little bit of driving. I'm just trying to think, trying to relate it back to my experience, which was marginal. I only did it for a couple of years on and off. I actually preferred the longer stuff. My UK is much smaller, though, I suppose, but the longer stuff in the UK is still, you know, very short by comparison to America. But I really enjoyed that. You know, you pop the radio on and you know, arm on the armrest, and I was very happy. Whereas the town stuff, you know, because, you know, tiny little villages and towns, delivering there, blocking the whole of the place while I faff about trying to reverse this thing, you know, and do a 3-point turn.
Well, your experience is way more than mine. When I say I did a couple of trips, I mean, I literally did 2 trips. You know, I did 2. So maybe less than 3,000 miles total. But what I do remember was very hard to find somewhere to park the truck at the truck stops. I had no interest in sleeping in a truck stop. You know, and then even when you're in the truck stop, there's like, there wasn't, you know, like good food, and it was always overpacked in the evenings. And I have so much empathy now for the long haul trucking. I think it's an incredibly difficult job. Yeah, I'm sure there's people that's the way of life they've selected, and that's what they want to do. And again, I'd like to emphasize, I do not think that long haul trucking in like the next 2-3 years is going to be an obsolete job. I think we have probably a decade before your job is really at any significant risk. You know, and even within that space, the shorter term, you know, middle mile, we call it, which is sort of, from the hub to, you know, distribution centers. So, and then the last mile, which is sort of the package delivery, you know, driving down the street.
Yeah.
You know, those autonomy are being applied as well, but a lot of the focus is on that long haul right now.
Have you learned something, Mike, accidentally?
Oh, yeah, I always learn accidentally. I never plan on becoming any more educated. No, it's interesting.
Really interesting and quite reassuring.
I suppose the only other thing, and this is me being the pessimist, but the old autonomous vehicle that gets into a collision, and then where does the responsibility lie? And I know we are some distance from way off doing this, but if you send your car off to the store to go and buy some milk and eggs, and it gets into a crash, you know, are you responsible? Is the car manufacturer responsible? Mm-hmm. If, you know, it's where is the legality going to be? And I imagine, you know, lawyers are going to be salivating at the prospect of who they can sue and what can happen. But I think it's maybe something we ought to sort of touch on and get your thoughts on.
Yeah. Well, let me start by saying that the privately owned level 4 autonomous vehicle is probably the farthest out there autonomous than there is, because it's expensive to build a level 4 vehicle, even if we knew how to do it, which we don't totally know how to do it yet. So the idea that you'll have a car in your driveway that you privately own that can go pick your kids up from school or go get eggs at the grocery store, I'd say is a very long way out if it ever happens. And another reason for that is, if a vehicle is truly that capable autonomously, it should be a shared resource, you know, because if your car can drive around and run errands, you're not going to let it sit in your driveway. You'll have it out there making you money by giving people rides or delivering things, you know. So it's almost certainly a corporation that would take some of that liability. And, you know, to be honest, I don't have a lot of insight into this space. I mean, I know that insurance companies and lawyers are looking at this, trying to understand it. I believe with that Mercedes level 3 system where, you know, I mentioned that where it operates on the highway and only in certain lanes and certain conditions, Mercedes has said that if anything happens while the system's active, Mercedes would be responsible. I believe that's the case. I should double check that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's some checks there as well that you can't activate it when you're not supposed to. But that's like, it's going to be interesting to see how that kind of plays out. There's definitely a hesitancy to call anything level 3, even if it's maybe capable. So I think some of the GM's like Super Cruise or Cadillac Super Cruise function, which was one of the really early high performance level 2 systems where you could really take your hand off the wheel and it sort of watch your eyes with a camera and make sure you're looking at the road. I actually believe some of those systems were capable of level 3, meaning that the car could pull over and really there was nothing that could happen the car couldn't handle. But I think they called it level two for just for this reason, that it was sort of, hey, whatever happens when it's level two, it's your job to be ready to take control. And I'm not, I don't have any inside information there, but that was kind of my take on it. So I think that's a huge question, is how the regulatory side is going to kind of catch up to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're having enough trouble regulating the internet. We've had that for 3 decades, and that's still an ongoing thing. So the idea, it's a bit like having a badly behaved dog, isn't it? And you let it off the lead and it goes running off the park and it comes back with something in its mouth. And you sort of think,
that's a bit of a...
I know, it just reminded me, but a friend of mine's cat one day wandered in through the cat flap with a set of keys to a BMW in its mouth and just coughed them on the floor. It's just like... Where have you got them from?
Yeah, I mean,
so if you walk out one day and there's a cycle embedded in the grill of your car, and you think, where's that come from? You know, it's there's got to be an issue of responsibility, and obviously this is something that
something else that's going to make this really hard is we know that human drivers are going to react differently to autonomous cars than normal cars, and at its simplest, it might just be cutting them off or knowing. One thing is, if the car is going to stop, are you just going to jaywalk all the time because you know that thing is going to stop? And the answer is probably
Come on, then. Come on.
I don't know. Sometimes, when I'm driving, it's like, I don't want to cut this guy off because he looks like an angry person and I don't want to get in a fight.
He's bigger than I am.
Yeah. It's going to be open season. So I think,
yes,
there's going to be some part of that as well, where you're going to have people brake checking the cars. And so the liability is going to have to cover some of that too. It's going
to
be really
just
tricky.
Just to see what happens.
Tricky. But
testing their reaction time to the car.
So we'll see autonomy all over. I think, the main place to look for it is where it's a limited operation in an area where there's no human drivers. That's going to happen really soon. It's already happening in a lot of places. And then it's going to be the really simple operational domain, simple cases where people are getting paid a lot to do it, or nobody wants to do it because it's so dangerous. That'll be next. And then the convenience stuff will probably come later, And so, but I think as car guys, we'll be all right for another decade at least here before they come for the keys.
Why do you never think of those pitfalls? Correction, why do I never think of them? You might. Continuous jaywalking and robot car taunting, of course, gonna happen. Great stuff, and thanks to Noah for joining us on Car Chum this time. If it's whetted your appetite, GPR can be found at, wait for it, gpr.com. There's some really good explanatory videos on there. Even we understood them. Talking of websites, try car-chum.com for the latest episodes, downloads, and a means to contact us directly. We'd love to hear from you. Car Chum will be back in a fortnight. Until then, pip pip.